I'm Brady Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, pay very close attention to the kind of people who are trying to strip you of your parental rights. Plus, Democrats launch a backdoor attack on the initiative process and too much. We'll save the owls. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided for our final live show of the week. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving Common Sense a comeback. A special thank you to Undivided subscribers who make this show possible. And I feel that way more and more every day. I mean, just the headline of today's show. Can you imagine if I'd said any one of those words, trans, disabled, queer, chicken ex, educational scholar on mainstream news? Couldn't have done it. So I get to work for you. It's the best people in the world to work for. I know Nicole shares my sentiment. We want to talk about two issues that are important and are connected: parental rights and the right of the people to initiative and referendum. I said during the 2024 election cycle that if we continued to give Democrats gains in this state, they would seek to undermine or undo the one way that people who dissent in this state can hold the party in power accountable. And that is the right to initiative. It is codified in the state constitution, and it truly is the last remaining way that we can push back about policies that are impacting our lives in deeply profound ways. You know, we have the right to referendum in this state, but Democrats have already found a way to nullify that. When they pass a bill that they know is going to be unpopular, what do? They attach an emergency clause onto the end of it, which says that we cannot run a referendum on it. So you have to go the route of an initiative, which is more costly, which is more difficult, which is less likely to succeed. So that's what so many Washingtonians, 1.8 million unique individual voters in this state, did throughout 2023 and 2024, is they pushed forth seven initiatives of the people that went, six of them went to the legislature, a seventh one was added on later, and four of them ended up on your ballot. And because that process was so successful, with four of the seven becoming law, Democrats will do anything they can to make the initiative process more difficult and undermine it at every opportunity. So we're going to talk today about two ways they're already doing that. One is, I think, sneakier and is going to get less attention than the one we'll start the show with today. So one of the initiatives that was passed into law by the legislature last year was Initiative 2081, which, of course, had to do with parental rights. We call it the Parental Bill of Rights, and it said that parents are the primary stakeholder in their kids' lives. And parents have a right to know what's happening with their kids at school. Parents have a right to know if their kids are being given mental health medication at school, if their kids are seeing a therapist for depression, if their child goes to school and identifies as a different name and a different gender. Parents have a right to know those things. And parents have a right to help their child navigate what can be, yes, a confusing time in a young person's life, especially in 2024 in America. So the legislature, run by Democrats, even though they do not agree with those sentiments whatsoever, they passed the Parental Bill of Rights into law. Why did they do that? We've talked about this a lot, but I want to underscore it for people who might be new to this conversation. They passed it into law almost unanimously because they didn't want to see it end up on the ballot. And those were the two options. Either they pass it or it goes to voters. They didn't want it to go to voters because they knew voters would pass it. They knew it would be a no-brainer that voters would say, yeah, I want to have parental rights in schools. Parents deserve to know what's happening with their kids at school. So they passed it because they didn't want it to go to voters. They don't want voters telling them that parents should have rights when it comes to what's happening with their kids in school. But they also passed it because if you pass an initiative via the legislature as opposed to voters passing it, that gives lawmakers far more power to be able to come back and undo it. And that's exactly what they're doing. So we talked about last week the Senate version of this bill. The House version of this bill had a hearing this morning in Olympia, 8 a.m. Was it 9 a.m.? 8 a.m.? 8 a.m.? 9 a.m.? Bright and early. No, it was 8 a.m. Bright and early. Yeah, as if they bury the most important bills, 8 a.m., and then they put this bill last and then rushed through testimony. Oh, we're short for time. The most important bill that the Education Committee in the House was going to hear the entire day for the entire committee, they put it last. They gave everything else before it all this time. And they crushed this to the last and said, oh, we got to speed up testimony. Sorry, we don't have room for the 55 people who showed up to testify. It is House Bill 1296. House Bill 1296 will undo some of the key provisions of the Parental Bill of Rights. They have no shame. They have no shame. They passed the bill into law, the initiative into law last year, knowing damn well that they would come back this legislative session and they would undo it. And they undo in this bill, 1296, some of the most important provisions, the most important aspects of the Parental Bill of Rights that got people to sign the initiative in the first place, about medications and medical care your kids might be receiving at school, mental health care, what's going on with your kids from a gender identity perspective. You know, they want to preach so much about how, oh, if you're going through if you're a transgender youth, you know, your life is very difficult for you, yet they want to cut you off from your parents and don't believe that your parents have a right to know that any of that is going on with you. So they're basically throwing the Parental Rights Initiative out the window with this. So I have a lot I want to play from the hearing this morning. I'll start with Representative Monica Stonier, who is the lead sponsor of House Bill 1296, a Democrat, who wanted to take a moment in introducing the bill to the committee to speak directly to kids.
For students who may be paying attention, whether you be wildly successful in school, whether you be with or without a home or documentation, whether you need support through an IEP or language support, and whether you identify as straight, gay, trans, however you show up, your success is our responsibility, and that's why I've offered the bill before you for the consideration of this committee.
And in saying that, she proves our point. She makes an argument for us. The success of our children is not your responsibility, Representative. You know, people want to talk often about, oh, it's a community. You know, raising kids is a community. No, you want to raise our kids in the way you see fit, with your political ideology, with your extreme gender ideology, and then you have the nerve to sit there and say, your success is our responsibility. Okay, if you're using the collective our, so is it not the parent's responsibility too, to help make sure and be part of ensuring that their child leads a successful life? And what I would also say to that, for this Democratic lawmaker who, oh, the legislature and Democrats and schools, you know, your success is our responsibility, and we're taking that back. How much success has there been? And what's your barometer for success? Because test scores are in the toilet, attendance is down, enrollment is down. So if the success of our kids is your responsibility, you're doing a pretty shitty job. And maybe we should take that responsibility back as parents, and that's what parents asked for with the Parental Bill of Rights. Representative Travis Couture, a Republican, asked a question that I'm sure a lot of parents would have asked of Representative Stonier if they were there.
As staff stated, you know, this erases the rights outlined in the Parents' Bill of Rights that was bipartisanly passed off the...
Do you have a question, Representative Couture?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. I'm getting to it.
You're taking away from public testimony, so please get to the question.
All right, here's my question. Why do you want schools to hide information about my kids from me? And what gives schools the right to decide what me as a parent deserve to know about my own children? Thank you.
Thank you for the question, Representative Couture. I imagine we will have a longer conversation about this after testimony, and I welcome a meeting with you and may my find time in your calendar to discuss just this. The rights of parents that were passed in the initiative and that we have discussed here in this committee do exist in other parts of statute. And if there is question about whether or not that information should be clearer, I welcome your feedback.
What a bullshit answer. Absolutely. I mean, first of all, that's how she answered every difficult question, is that we could talk about this more later. No, that's what the public hearing is for. She said that multiple times to Republican state lawmakers who asked for legitimate questions. Well, you know, I'm sure we can meet later. I'd love to meet with you. Well, isn't that nice? You'd love to meet with them behind closed doors because you don't want to answer their question because you know you don't have a good answer to their question. Well, the public can all see it. Like, that's so convenient. And for her to say and repeat the lie that these rights for parents are codified elsewhere in state statute just isn't true. That's what Democrats said, remember, last year when they passed the Parental Bill of Rights. Well, we can pass this because these protections are already in law for parents, so this Bill of Rights really doesn't do anything. Okay, if it doesn't do anything, then why are you going through it with a big fat Sharpie marker this year? If it didn't do anything, why do you feel the need to undo it less than a year later? That doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? Now, if you had any doubt in the world that this is about the left trying to force their politics and their extreme gender ideology on kids, if you had any doubt in the world that that's what this is about, being able to indoctrinate kids in our public schools, I want you to listen to the testimony in favor of this bill to undo the Parental Bill of Rights from a woman named Tracy Castro Gill.
My name is Dr. Tracy Castro Gill. My pronouns are they, them. I am a disabled queer Chicanx educator and scholar in Washington State with my expertise on curriculum and instruction. These are markers that were made illegal recently in the federal government. However, my very presence and humanity is in opposition to that legislation. I want to remind us that George Orwell, in his novel 1984, warned us about limiting how we are allowed to define ourselves and our experiences, and how that allows fascism to take root. Teachers have historically held the gap between humanity and fascism, often becoming the primary targets of fascist regimes, and we're seeing that play out currently.
Excuse me, can you keep your focus on the provisions of this bill?
Yes.
And may also just ask, you signed in pro.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your testimony?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. Please continue.
Yes, and so the fact that teachers have stood in the gap and are the primary targets are why I'm testifying pro, because of the protections for educators. Educators, as we've heard from students, are often the people who foster student identity and development, and are currently being targeted and pushed out of their positions because of this fact. I also teach at the University of Washington and hear the curriculum violence and harm and how they're being erased in their K-12 programs, much the way that I and other gender expansive people were erased by Representative McIntyre in this very room today.
Excuse me, ma'am. We don't impugn members. Please proceed carefully.
Thank you. So I ask that we amend the legislation. I am in favor of it, but we amend it to add stronger protections for educators, including existing language in the CCDEI and the Ethnic Studies OSPI framework that provide support for teaching about race and racism.
Thank you.
Like, look, I can laugh about that. That is ridiculous. That's an absolute clown show. But in reality, you can tell a lot about the purpose of a bill by paying close attention to the people who support it and what their motivations are and what they care about and what their end game might be. And in truth, besides all of her various pronouns and things that describe her, we actually know a lot about Tracy Castro Gill. It's interesting that she wants this bill to include more protections for teachers because she herself was an educator in the Seattle Public School District, one of the wokest school districts in the nation, but she was considered so extreme that she lost her job even with SPS. In fact, the Daily Wire did an investigative report on Tracy Castro Gill, the woman you just heard from, back in 2022. The headline, "Meet the Seattle School's Woke Indoctrination Czar, Who Married a Child Molester." And they share a lot about her background and how she operated within the Seattle Public School District. It says, "At the forefront of Seattle Public Schools' initiatives around gender and race was Tracy Castro Gill, until recently its director of ethnic studies, who represented herself as a fierce Chicana who overcame homelessness and was willing to take on racism no matter who she had to battle, turning schools into vehicles for social change. Castro Gill, it turned out, was a perennial unhappy toxic liar, one who misrepresented her background to the point that her own father compared her to Rachel Dolezal, the white woman who pretended to be black, and who was ultimately pushed out of her job for repeated misconduct. A focus on racial oppression did not create resiliency, but rather despondency, with Castro Gil and three other racial justice leaders going on paid leave from SPS for mental health issues in 2019 alone. As Castro Gil used children for politics in the workplace, her personal life also raised questions about the cost that can incur. She married a convicted child molester and moved her young daughter in with him. Then, her previous ex-husband told me she pressured her child, who had serious mental impairments, to become gender non-binary. And that is the kind of person who is a big, big fan of House Bill 1296. A trans-disabled queer chicken ex educational scholar who believes Trump's a fascist, who married a child molester, moved her young daughter in with them, and then, according to her ex-husband, pressured her young daughter, despite her serious mental impairments, to become gender non-binary. That's the person who gets to sit before legislative leaders in Olympia and advocate for you to have your parental rights stripped from you, to advocate for teachers and educators like herself to be able to keep secrets from parents about what's going on with their kids at school. That tells you everything you need to know about the motivations behind House Bill 1296 and the motivations of the Democratic majority in Olympia. And those motivations are extreme. They're out of line with, I think, what most Washington families want, which of course is why they didn't want this to go to the ballot, because it would be much harder for them to sit there and make these arguments against parental rights if the voters of the state of Washington on the ballot said they want them. And that's just one of the many ways that they seek to undo and undermine the initiative process. I want to play a few more things. You heard, I just want to explain something that she said. Can you just play the back half of that, those comments from that person?
I also teach at the University of Washington and hear the curriculum violence and harm and how they're being erased in their K-12 programs, much the way that I and other gender expansive people were erased by Representative McIntyre in this very room today.
Yeah. So what did Representative McIntyre say? Here it is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this legislation bring us closer or further away from the federal direction where they're rightly relying on the science and ridding themselves of the gender expansive nonsense, which isn't really based in science?
Yeah, so he questioned how it was in line with the new federal rules that Trump is putting down. So she got up and said he erased them, completely erased them. I also, though, his question there is relevant. You know, the federal government is going a certain way with all this gender ideology nonsense, as he called it. But Washington State seems to be trying to backpedal in the other direction and go back to how they were a couple years ago with all this gender ideology in schools. The answer, again, I go back to Rep. Monica Stonier, and I want to play the answer she gave him on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this legislation bring us closer or further away from the federal direction where they're rightly relying on the science and ridding themselves of the gender expansive nonsense, which isn't really based in science?
Representative McIntyre, where federal law has been helpful, we have to look to that language, and you heard my question about the language with regard to FERPA. Existing federal law is consistent with the goals of this bill, that language is relied upon and incorporated into the bill.
Wait a second. Can you play that again, that last part? Just play it again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this legislation bring us closer or further away from the federal direction where they're rightly relying on the science and ridding themselves of the gender expansive nonsense, which isn't really based in science?
Representative McIntyre, where federal law has been helpful, we have to look to that language, and you heard my question about the language with regard to FERPA. Existing federal law is consistent with the goals of this bill, that language is relied upon and incorporated into the bill.
Oh, where federal law is consistent with the goals of the bill, federal law is relied upon. So the only federal law that they're weaving throughout the bill is the federal law that they think makes their point. That is a stunning statement. And where federal law is in conflict, they just ignore it. That is a stunning statement for a state lawmaker to make. So again, you have them, almost unanimously, let's pass the Parental Bill of Rights. Oh yeah, we love it. We think it's great. Oh, you know, and actually we already have these protections for parents, so it's sort of redundant, but we'll pass it anyway. Less than a year later, they come back, they introduce the very beginning of the session, a bill to completely unravel it. They also attach, you guessed it, an emergency clause onto the end of it because they know that that prevents us from running a referendum on it. So the only sort of recourse you have is to do the initiative process all over again with the Parental Bill of Rights, try to re-solidify the rights that were in there in the first place, and then bypass the legislature completely and send it to the voters. And it's going to cost millions of dollars to do that. Hundreds and hundreds of hours of time for volunteers and paid signature gatherers. Because they don't care what you think. They don't care about the initiative process. They don't care that it's codified in the Constitution. They will do everything they can to demolish it in order to push their agenda. And again, if the agenda isn't clear, you just have to listen to that woman's testimony. This is about pushing radical gender ideology and their politics on kids. And they think, the state thinks it can do a better job than you can at being a parent. Their teachers can be better at talking to your kids about problems. They're counselors, but you as a parent, you can't be trusted to help your child navigate these complex times. As if parents throughout history haven't helped their teenage kids navigate those precious years before those confusing, difficult years before they could become adults. Yeah, but parents in 2024, you can't be trusted. The issues that kids are facing are simply too complex and too confusing. Only teachers can do that. That's not the only thing happening today to undermine the initiative process. Now, I predicted that if Democrats reached supermajorities, they would just try to push through a constitutional amendment to do away with the initiative process altogether. Now, they don't have supermajorities yet. They're very close. They don't have them yet. So they have to find all these backdoor ways and sneaky ways to try to undermine the initiative process. Here is a bill that isn't getting as much attention that seeks to do just that. It is Senate Bill 5382. And it makes changes to the initiative process. Now, some of it sounds sort of in the weeds, and some of it even sounds, dare I say, reasonable. But there's nothing reasonable about it. They will say, and I guarantee it, as this moves through the committee, they will say, these are reasonable steps meant to protect the initiative process. We want to protect the democratic process and your right to initiative. And it will be, as most things they do, complete and utter gaslighting. So there's two key things that Senate Bill 5382 does. So it says, in the language, I'm right, because the language is this, to adequately guard the people's initiative and referendum right against fraud and mistake. Oh my God, thank you. Thank you for trying to adequately guard our right to initiative and referendum. You are so kind. It says the legislature determines that the law must be clarified to require each petition signature gatherer circulating an initiative or referendum petition to sign the declaration under penalty of false swearing. So basically, they want to make it so that if you're out there collecting, you've got this page that has 20 signatures. On every single page, you have to declare that to the best of your knowledge, the signatures are valid at the bottom of it under penalty of false swearing. So you might say, well, that doesn't sound unreasonable. You have some of these signature gatherers who go out and they collect hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of pages. So this is just another step where they want to, if someone forgets, if you're a citizen volunteer, or you're someone out there who's put in hours of time collecting these signatures, they want to be able to, if you forget to sign every single page, they want to nullify the entire page of signatures. Because again, they know that the only people running these initiatives at this point are conservatives, are people who don't agree with them and their policies. So they want you to jump through as many hoops as possible, and they want to look for ways, as many ways as they can find, to invalidate the signatures that you turn in. Now, I will say, I don't believe that that is constitutional. Courts have held that really any effort from the legislature, because the initiative process is designed to hold the legislature accountable, really any efforts for the legislature to further regulate the initiative process have not done well in court. So I'm hopeful that they won't find sort of a sympathetic court, although that's pretty easy in Washington state. But the case law here is pretty clear. And as you go about, and we went out and we collected signatures for initiatives, you don't have to sign the bottom of it. You don't have to right now. They want you to have to because they want to be able to throw out as many as humanly possible. The other aspect of the bill, it says, for purposes of verifying a signature on an initiative or referendum petition, the Secretary of State shall verify that the resident's address on the petition or paper is the same as the resident's address on the affidavit of voter registration. So they, again, they want to put even the Secretary of State's office through extra hoops to jump through to verify, even if it's a valid voter. Let's say you just moved and you put your new address, but your voter registration is at an old address. They want to nullify your signature. They want to find as many ways as possible to make the initiative process more difficult, more cumbersome, and ultimately less successful. That's exactly what this, and the reason you know that that's what this bill is about, is it is entirely sponsored by Democrats. And Democrats would have no motivation to strengthen the initiative process. They would have no motivation, as they say, to adequately guard the people's initiative and referendum rights. And we know that they've spoken poorly about the initiative process. They have no motivation to do something that hurts them electorally or at the ballot box. So anything you see coming from Democrats that is about the initiative process will be about damaging it and undermining it. And that's what this bill is. It's basically a big screw you, Brian Haywood bill. We're going to make it more expensive, more time-consuming for you to run initiatives in the future. But it's really not. It's more like screw you, voters, and screw you, democracy. Because Democrats don't want to know what you think. They don't want to hear any dissent. They don't want to hear ideas from the people that they serve. They want to be able to lord over you with their massive majorities and push through any bill that tickles their fancy. All right, coming up next, we have a double dose of unbelievable. First, if you're thinking about selling your home in 2025, reach out to our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. Wes and his team have an innovative marketing strategy that will help your home stand out on the market, and you need it right now. I mean, the housing market is slow, but if you do things right, you can still get a really good offer on your home. Here's Wes.
You know, I'm hearing a lot of things. People are, oh, gosh, well, you know, there might be a recession coming up. I'm like, hey, guys, anybody working in real estate has been living it for like the last 30 months or so. It's a strange conundrum, though, because sales are low, but prices are still very, very high. You can still sell and you can plan on making a lot of money, but you might have to prepare your home a little bit harder and do a little bit more work than you have in the past because buyers are a little bit, you know, less forgiving.
Yeah, and the good news, Wes can help you with all of that. He can take the stress off you for the process, give you a free market analysis, tell you how much you can expect for offers for your home, just give you some predictability, and he can even help you make cosmetic upgrades and pay for it up front if you need. So sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, let's do it. How about a double dose of unbelievable, starting with a statement from the University of Washington about that violent protest against a conservative speaker. All right, we discussed this on the show yesterday, how left-wing violence is totally okay in Washington. There's no other, I mean, you can't think anything else. It's been totally okay for years and years and years. There's hardly ever any consequences. So left-wing violence is not only okay, it's completely just, and we need to support it. So at the University of Washington a couple nights ago, Turning Point USA sponsored a speaker named Olivia, who was talking about protecting girls' spaces, girls in sports, et cetera. And so UW, you know, they say that they're willing to host events from both sides. And so Turning Point USA was able to have this event. But of course, it turned into a complete crapshoot because left-wing Antifa showed up and they caused chaos both inside by pulling a fire alarm and then police got there. So Antifa was pushed outside, but they still continued to not only harass and disrupt the event, but hold the people at the event hostage in what I would consider unlawful imprisonment. Here's a clip.
They're banging on the door. We are finally able to get into the room. We have a couple people in here with us, and they just keep banging on the doors. It's really annoying. Yelling.
Yeah, pretty horrifying. And as usual, UW police just stood there and did nothing. Also, outside, there was a larger group that was gathered protesting, and no doubt they were violated, I mean, they broke a window, they assaulted a guy.
Okay, a man disagreeing with you is not a predator.
Yeah, so it was, I mean, it's horrific. You know, you're literally holding students and a speaker hostage inside a building. Later on in the night, they had to sneak them out in groups of three surrounded by police officers for a campus that has been under the spotlight a lot in the last year or so for the left-wing violence or activity on campus, like the takeover of the quad and the mass destruction of buildings. You would think that UW's like, hey, we really should probably arrest these people. We really should show that we don't think left-wing violence and extremism on our campus is okay. But of course, can't be bothered to do that. I will say, though, I didn't even expect such a jaw-dropping statement from the University of Washington's spokesperson. I expected it to be tepid, weak. I didn't expect them to blame Olivia and Turning Point USA for the situation. It's insane to me. I'm going to read the full statement for you. I can just throw it up on screen here because I'm baffled by it. And I followed up with UW to ask them some follow-up questions about this real, real doozy. It says, the University of Washington is committed to free exchange of ideas and the principles of academic freedom in accordance with the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, including some whose views may be considered controversial. So I love the first line. They're suggesting that, you know, wanting boys not to compete against girls in sports is controversial. So you already know where UW stands on that, which it's not a controversial viewpoint. It's really not. Most Americans don't support it. So it's like, oh, you know, Antifa showing up and stuff, and that's not controversial. But Olivia being there, sharing her stuff, totally controversial. They go on to say, UW police leadership was in conversation with organizers of Tuesday night's event several weeks ago to discuss plans to make it run as smoothly as possible and safely. The student group that invited the speaker unfortunately changed its plans during the course of the day. The group committed to requiring registration by attendees in advance of the event and did not follow through on that requirement. Okay. The responsibility for interrupting last night's event falls on those whose actions were disruptive and damaging, including breaking a window, graffiti in the building, and wasting firefighters' time with a false fire alarm. Anyone who is identified to have been responsible for vandalism or property damage will be pursued through legal channels. The event organizers made the decision to suspend the event. UWPD escorted event participants out of the building. Informed discussion and debate are encouraged on our campus. However, it is clear that presenters and disruptors are in some cases seeking to antagonize one another in ways that provide dramatic content for their social media feeds. Tuesday's scheduled speaker told the student newspaper that she was excited the event was shut down. Again, those seeking to disrupt and shut down speakers are ultimately responsible and will face legal and disciplinary action if they are identified. It is also important for organizers to follow advice provided by UWPD regarding security if the true intention is to hold an event without disruption. The cost to the university, the state, and taxpayers to allow our campus to serve as the backdrop for these disruptions and exchanges is significant, and we will continue to do everything we can to enable student groups to host events with disruption. That is the equivalent of saying, yeah, but she asked for it. Like, oh, she wore a short skirt, so she asked to be raped. That's like the equivalent of that. And let me be clear. I do believe that Turning Point USA hosts and holds some of these events, knowing full well that it's going to lead to these sorts of exchanges that will be great social media content. I have no doubt in my mind. But that does not manifest unless left-wing violent extremists decide they're so triggered by speech that they show up and hurt people and break things. So UW in here sort of placid is like, well, you know, if we can identify anyone who is identified to have been responsible for vandalism or property damage, we pursued through legal channels. Police were there. Police, Bennett got the assault against him on camera, went right up to a police officer immediately after and said, I want to press charges. And police said, nah, we can't do anything about it. So you could have identified them and arrested them in the moment and you chose not to because you give your police hands off when it comes to the left wing. If that was the Proud Boys out there harassing some sort of liberal group, you never would have allowed it. You would have arrested them on site. So there's, oh, we'll hold them accountable if we could only find them. They were right there for hours and hours. You could have arrested any one of them. And you chose not to. This also idea, and this is the question I asked you, Dub, why would it matter? It said that the organizers committed to requiring registration by attendees in advance of the event and did not follow through on that requirement. Why would that matter? Requiring registration of attendees would not have stopped the left wing from showing up, from breaking a window, from graffitiing on the walls, from assaulting someone outside, from banging on the door screaming, "Let us in, who's in there?" and from holding them hostage inside by surrounding the building. Registration wouldn't have prevented any of that. It makes no sense in the world. And UWPD, it wants to act like, oh my gosh, the cost to the university and the state and taxpayers is significant for us to continue to do this. Who's to blame? You have fostered and allowed this kind of behavior for years and years and years. You allowed pro-Hamas sympathizers to harass Jewish students and take over the quad for what, 3 weeks? It was like weeks, right? And now, and then to go on to vandalize the UW president's home and car and all that. And now you're like, this is just getting out of control. Yeah, that's what we've been saying. And you let it get out of control. So you're responsible for fixing it. And fixing it means, in the moment, stopping it from happening, holding people accountable for their criminal conduct and trespassing them so they can never come back to campus again. And if they do, just stepping foot on campus is a criminal offense. But you won't do any of that because left-wing extremism is perfectly fine in Washington State, in Seattle, and on the campus of the University of Washington. Shameful, shameful, shameful. All right, let's get to our second dose of unbelievable. All right. The Washington Policy Center has sued the Washington State Department of Ecology over an issue we've discussed on the show before. The state has been and the Department of Ecology have been violating their own climate laws. They are supposed to regularly report CO2 emissions so that we know, oh, all these costly climate goals and the Climate Commitment Act and this agenda and electric cars and all this stuff. So we know if it's having a positive impact. Isn't that what we all want? Can we breathe cleaner air? Is all this stuff working? Are all these sacrifices worth it? Yet for years and years and years, they weren't releasing the CO2 data that they're required to release by law. So the Washington Policy Center is suing over it. And Todd Myers with the Policy Center, who is an expert on all these climate laws and policies, joins us to discuss. Todd Myers, welcome back to Undivided.
Always nice to join you.
Yeah, so help the average Washingtonian understand why they should care about this.
So we sued the Department of Ecology because they are required to publish CO2 emissions data for the state. You know, no matter how you feel about CO2 policy or climate policy, you should at least want to know that the money we are spending is being effective. And the data that we have right now is not only very old, it's 2021, we're in 2025, it also makes it impossible for us to determine, are we reaching our goals, are we not, what's working, what's not. So by law, they should have released through 2023. We sued them yesterday. The Department of Ecology doesn't even pretend that they're in compliance. What they simply say is, well, it's too complicated to get data more recent. Now, of course, if the Department of Ecology comes after you for not complying with the regulation and you say, well, gee, I'd love to comply, but it's too complicated, they would never accept that from you. But somehow they expect us to accept that. And it's particularly absurd when they're the ones who are saying that this is an existential crisis. Yeah. If it's an existential crisis, then do your job and get the information so that we know that we can address it in an effective way. And the fact that they haven't, I think, really indicates that's why we sued them, is because the gap between their performance and their rhetoric is so great.
Now, do you believe the excuse that it's because it's too complicated, or do you believe it's like more nefarious, like the numbers don't show what they might want them to show, so it's just better not to release them?
I think it's actually that they don't care. They know the policies they want. And the numbers are sort of superfluous. It doesn't matter whether the numbers are good or bad. They're going to do what they're going to do, which is more regulation, more government spending. So I don't think that they care whether the numbers are good or bad. And in fact, I went back and looked at all of their press releases in the past when they've released data. And every time emissions have gone up, in those press releases, they say, our policies are working. In other words, they don't actually look, they don't actually use the data to determine what policies or what works and what doesn't. They just are convinced. And it's very funny. I mean, year after year, emissions would go up. And every time there'd be a quota in there that says our policies are working. So I don't think they're hiding anything. I just think they don't care.
Yeah. My question, though, is could this have the opposite of the intended impact? You know, if this is climate law, what's stopping them from just saying, okay, well, let's just undo that climate law so we don't have to provide these numbers at all?
Great, then they can change the law. But I think that, you know, then make the legislature vote to hide the data, to affirmatively hide the data, rather than just not doing their job. Again, they're just simply ignoring a law. None of us could get away with that. They would never allow that. But they are just ignoring the law. And they have excuses. One of their excuses is, well, that we rely on the federal government for some data and they haven't released it. I don't believe that that's true. In fact, the EPA has released state-by-state CO2 emissions data through 2022, a year later than the state. So I just think that they don't care.
Yeah, well, and you would think, though, if the climate is this big thing and they're, you know, pushing all these things and it's working, that they should be so proud to put this information out. They're like, oh, my gosh, look what we're doing for the environment. And the fact that they're not, I mean, the skeptic in me is like, tells me what I need to know. I would just ask, you know, Bob Ferguson has come in and kind of, he wants us to believe he's turned over a new leaf. You know, he's going to be very transparent. He just hired Jesse Jones, you know, from Get Jesse to run this government website that should be tracking these things that has been instead burying the data. So do you have hope that they'll be more transparent on some of these issues as time goes on?
Yes. Why not have hope, right? I mean, so work with them and make them show that they're not living up to their rhetoric. But their rhetoric is good. So, okay, it's just rhetoric. I get that. So let's take some actions. And I have been critical of Results Washington. I probably am one of, you know, only two human beings in Washington State who paid any attention at all to Results Washington over the past few years. So I'm going to go, I hope to meet with them and talk to them about the failures during the Inslee administration and how to make it better. So at this point, I have hope, but we'll see in the future.
Let me just end with this. Trump has been doing a lot of things, environmental related, energy. Anything stand out to you?
Yeah, I think some of the stuff on the offshore wind and wind, you know, turbines and things like that and the permits, I think that's great. Pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, I think that's fantastic. The Paris Climate Accord is sort of a charade. We have all these countries that go around and say, look how great we are for signing it, even as they're not meeting their own obligations, right? Much like we do in Washington State. They made some changes to DEQ, which oversees NEPA, which is all the federal regulations. So there's lots of things. It's kind of chaos right now. It's hard to sort out. I think we'll see how it sorts out. But there's a lot of changes that need to be made. And the focus that people have is on the cost, the permitting, the tax, you know, those sorts of things. But from my standpoint, we need to reduce those regulations to help the environment. In many cases, government right now is the biggest barrier to doing things for the environment. So I think it can also be, if we do this the right way, not just getting rid of wasteful bureaucracy, but getting wasteful bureaucracy out of the way so that we can do good things for the environment. So that's so I'm hopeful on that too. So I'm trying to have a hopeful tone right now.
Hey, I like it. Always reason to be hopeful, but I know you'll hold them accountable if they don't live up to it. So Todd Myers, thank you for breaking it down for us.
Yep, nice to chat with you.
Yeah, super suspicious. Oh, we're doing such great things for the climate. We can't show you. Top secret CO2 emissions data. Can't show you that. It's not important enough. But we're doing really great things for the climate. Totally rings true. Totally. All right, we have some breaking news on the immigration front that I want to get to right after this word from our sponsor, because Nicole and we're kind of making sense of it right now. But so I've encouraged you guys to take the First Mark Challenge, firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com, because it could save money. You could even get better insurance for less money. So it's like, why wouldn't you do it? It doesn't cost you anything. I'm a member of the First Mark family. Nicole is. Undivided is insured through First Mark. And it's because it's an exceptional service. We don't get any sort of deal because they're an advertiser. We just did the First Mark Challenge ourselves, liked what they brought back to us with our insurance options. And so we decided to become members of the First Mark family. You can take the First FirstMark Challenge, firstmarkinsurance.com, totally free. You just have to set aside a little time to talk to them about your insurance needs, your current insurance, et cetera. And then they'll go out, shop the market for you, come back with their recommendations. So firstmarkinsurance.com, like other Undivided viewers and listeners, just an hour of time set aside could help save you hundreds, if not thousands of dollars a year. It really is a no-brainer. Firstmarkinsurance.com, the very best part is they work for you. Okay, a couple things going on right now that are actually relevant, well, all immigration related. So first, a federal judge in Seattle just a couple hours ago blocked President Donald Trump's executive order on birthright citizenship. Of course, Washington State Attorney General Nick Brown came out day two of the Trump administration, took him 2 days to sue the Trump administration. That was over birthright citizenship. Not a surprise that a federal judge in Seattle would halt that policy for the time being. I actually don't think the policy is constitutional. I think it's just a very clear violation of the 14th Amendment. So we'll see how this plays out in the courts. But Seattle, again, at the forefront of suing the Trump administration and just got a victory in court. Some other news that's happening. There is an account in Seattle that sort of tracks happenings around crime that is saying that ICE agents have been spotted in downtown Seattle, kind of in the 3rd and Pike Pine area. So we're working to get confirmation on that. Would not be a surprise because there have been confirmed ICE raids happening in other blue cities in America. But it goes hand in hand with this statement that came out this morning from the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction. And that goes hand in hand with our daily subscriber show poll, which I'll get to in a moment. So OSPI, the head of OSPI, Chris Rakedahl, posted this across their platforms. Today, OSPI released guidance on state and federal protections for immigrant students in Washington's K-12 public schools. The guidance provides schools with a roadmap of requirements related to student privacy, access to educational services, and immigration enforcement on school campuses. Rakedahl says, in Washington State, we will do everything we can to protect our students, no matter their citizenship status. Our state constitution ensures access to basic education for every child residing within our state's borders. Our constitution does not identify citizenship as a qualification to receive an education. State and federal law prohibit public school districts from discriminating on the basis of race, color, or national origin, and state law further prohibits discrimination on the basis of citizenship or immigration status. So they're very clearly concerned about ICE or deportation efforts being carried out against students both on and off school property. They have some guidance for what they say protecting immigrant students, but kind of unknown what they're able to do if ICE wants to. I mean, if ICE shows up to a home and they've got a student there who's a student of our public school district, but they're in the country illegally, OSPI can't do anything about that. Now, I think there's a question about to what extent can ICE access our public schools and to what extent do people want them to? So I asked that of our subscribers this morning. It just so happened that at the time I was pushing that poll out on Patreon, Locals, and X, OSPI was also pushing out its guidance. And I think this is a tough question. I think it's a moral conundrum. It says, my poll to you guys, generally speaking, should Immigration and Customs Enforcement carry out deportation efforts inside schools, or for that matter, I mean, like outside of school? Yes or no? Nicole, do you have a strong opinion on that? Yes or no?
I would say no.
I agree.
Don't think it's appropriate. And I think if you're, you know, investigating the situation, then you can watch where the kid goes home and deal with it at home, but not in front of a bunch of kids and not put kids watching and kids going through that in front of their students.
I have to agree with that. If you put that much investigative effort into finding out that there's kids, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I don't know if they're going into schools and saying, tell us who's illegal and who's not, but the school isn't even tracking that stuff. Then I agree with you that you could find other ways to, if you need to take that person or their parents into custody to do it. The vast majority of Undivided subscribers, 70%, are saying no. Mm-hmm. That generally speaking, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and our fan base is pretty conservative. So most of you do not want the Trump administration and ICE to carry out deportation efforts in schools. And I have to agree with that. And a lot of them saying what you say, Nicole. Jen R. says, no, this could be a bit traumatic for all students. Let's keep the focus on criminal adults. And yeah, if you're keeping the focus on criminal adults, some kids might end up being part, like Tom Holman says, we'll deport the entire family together. There's no family separation. So if you're a family and you're all here illegally, then yeah, there's going to be kids swept up in these mass deportation efforts. But singling out or searching for kids at school, I just don't see that as being appropriate. Carenza says, at the time, I don't think a school should be allowing criminals to seek asylum in them. So she believes that it would be appropriate. Brandon Ferris, I don't care where they're at. If they're a violent criminal, which is why they're even on the list, get them out of there. So obviously you must be talking about teachers. So does it change it? If it's a teacher who's like, he said, a violent criminal or some sort of like school staffer, does that change your mind, Nicole? If it's a staffer they're seeking out versus a kid.
Again, I think you can just wait till they walk out of school.
Like, wait till they go home.
Yeah, you can just sit outside and wait for them.
I agree. Robert says, yes, but with discretion, most of all for illegals who have committed crimes against children. Hopefully they're not in schools, but Lord only knows.
And if that's the case, then you might be able to be like, hi, can you please come out?
Yeah, like, hey, you know.
We're going to take you away from the children.
Yeah. Yeah, I think maybe I should have been more specific in my question about whether it's targeting kids or educators or staffers who might be in a school environment. Caddy says on locals, our schools cannot handle the influx of illegals. Did you know they don't have to prove their age? So they could even be older than they claim they are. Yeah, I don't know what the age requirement is. I don't know what the documentation requirement is. Dan says schools should support the rule of law. What message does it send that within the school doors they break the law? Nope, there are exceptions. There are no exceptions. It is the law. Yeah, I, for one, just leave schools out of it. If you got to pick up somebody who's a staff member, a teacher, or even a kid of an illegal immigrant you might have just picked up as part of an ICE raid, you can wait till they leave school. I don't see any reason to do that. I haven't seen any examples of that yet. I could have missed it. I don't have my eyes and ears on everything, but I haven't seen any examples of kids being scooped up by ICE at schools as part of this mass deportation thing. But obviously, we're going to keep our eyes on all of that. A ton going on, and the immigration situation is developing by the moment. And I don't think it's going to be pretty when they start carrying out mass deportations in Seattle. I think there's going to be unrest on the streets. I'm for it, though. If you're in the country illegally as an adult, I think ICE needs to get this situation under control. But we know how Washington State and its leaders and the left-wing political violent extremists are going to react to that. And so I think we have some concerning days ahead, certainly, as all this carries out. All right, I wanted to play, I've been meaning to play a clip of this all week, but we've been so busy, and so I wanted to do it today. On Sunday's show, we had on Oregon State lawmaker Ed Deal talking about an issue that impacts us in Washington State and across the Pacific Northwest. So there are two kinds of owls at the center of this story, a barred owl and a spotted owl. They look almost identical. In fact, Nicole, are you sure? You've labeled one of those a barred owl and one a spotted owl. How confident are you?
I had to check it multiple times.
You 100%? You feeling good?
99.9, unless somebody tricked me.
I don't know. So the issue is that the federal government wants to murder about 500,000 barred owls because they say the barred owl is like more aggressive. So they're killing the spotted owls and that's not cool. So they want to come in, send people in. And it's going to cost like billions of dollars over many years to see if they can kill enough barred owls to make a difference in the spotted owl population.
By the way, they're both equally adorable.
They're adorable.
They're not, you know, I don't know, mean-looking, well, gross-looking, like,
who would want
I don't know.
Who'd want to hunt hooters?
I don't know.
I mean, I can see some men wanted to hunt the other kind of hooters, but not these ones. They're so cute. And Rep. Ed Deal thinks so, too. He was a great guy, great guest on Sunday's show. You should definitely watch it. But he posted on X, eliminating one owl species to protect another is both absurd and destined for failure. This scheme will waste an estimated $1 billion of Americans' hard-earned tax money without any justifiable benefit. Elon Musk, we are asking Doge to put a stop to this. And they did, indeed, a bipartisan group of Oregon, I used to say that in Minnesota. People are going to kill me. Oregon lawmakers sent a letter to the House of Representatives, but they also sent it to Doge and the directors of the Department of Government Efficiency, basically saying, hey, this is a waste of time. It's not going to work. It's a waste of money. And what's the point? Like, let nature do what nature is going to do. So we don't know if Doge is going to take up the case yet. It certainly would have implications for Washington State as well. But here's a clip of my conversation with Oregon State Representative Ed Deal on Sundays with Subscribers. You guys wrote a letter to Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, yes, and to Doge, right? Which I'm super excited about Doge to see what they can do. Did you just see that as, hey, this is an opportunity to, now we have an entity that's going to be looking at this waste. So I imagine that this letter, this isn't the first time you guys have questioned this plan.
No. I first learned about this several months ago. The Forest Service has been talking about it for at least 2 years, I believe. But we just saw an opportunity with the new administration, with a focus on government efficiency and government waste. And we had a bipartisan letter. We were one Democrat was willing to sign on with three Republicans to write this letter, and we thought, hey, let's do this. Let's get the attention of DOGE. This seems like a great example of what we're battling in the Northwest. And actually, I hope that it leads to a real look again at the Endangered Species Act. It's like, is this accomplishing what we really want to accomplish? Maybe we should, instead of look at particular species, look at the entire ecosystem, and figure out how to way to balance human needs for jobs and recreation and everything else with the needs of the animals.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting because, in this letter, there's a couple things that are interesting here to me, because one of your key arguments is like, hey, like nature is going to nature, right? And the government trying to intervene with sort of a natural process. I mean, where is the line there, right? Because you do have human activities that do hurt habitat and things like that. So to you, what's the line between, yeah, let's try to compensate a little bit for what humans are doing to some of these habitats for animals that might be endangered or on the verge of extinction, and okay, that's too much intervention.
I don't know if I could answer where I exactly see that line. I just look at this scenario here. I don't know if I could tell the difference between one of these owls and the other. They're close cousins, right? And they're both owls. It's not like we're talking about two completely different animals. And this, the spotted owl has been in danger for a long time. It's struggling in this environment. So with the fact that they're so similar, and the fact that we're looking at spending well over $1 billion, and we're never going to end up with a situation where the spotted owl thrives, we're just trying to keep it barely surviving. It just doesn't make any sense.
A lot of things the federal government does don't make any sense. Yeah, I don't want you to kill it. Look, if one of the owls has to die, let it be the weaker one who can't survive on their own unless you murder 500,000 of their cousins. It just doesn't make any sense. So I'm very interested. We'll have to tag Doge and Elon and all of this stuff, because Vivek's no longer with Doge. I think he's going to run for governor of Ohio, which will be interesting. But I just love that conversation because it's an issue that we wouldn't usually talk about, but it encompasses so many of the things: government waste, bad environmental policy. So you can watch my full interview with Oregon State Representative Ed Deal on Sundays with subscribers this past week. You can subscribe undividedpod.com. And I would do that now, actually, because you know what we have coming up this Sunday on Sundays with subscribers? We have an interview with John Cameron. He's a local J6er who just got a pardon from President Donald Trump. And so he's going to join us for an in-depth conversation about what he went through personally, about getting the pardon and all of that. So sign up to become a subscriber today. It's only $5 a month. UndividedPod.com. UndividedPod.com. Okay. Happening this weekend, Natchez RV Resort is showcasing a new phase of their grand opening. And these are the best lots at the entire place, because nothing is going to be built behind them. So there is definitely some privacy there. These are 25 premium extra large RV lots they have available in this, and they are ready. They don't open up lots until they're ready to go. And like, if you could drive an RV there today, they start in the low 70s, and there's so much at this resort. I mean, it really is top of the line. The pool and hot tub are now open. They've got a dog park, children's playground, pickleball courts, tennis, miles of recreational trails, and a ton of things to do year round. 300 days of sunshine. We'll start there. But there's a ton of things you can do: wine tasting, hunting, fishing, and all of that within the vicinity of Natchez RV Resort. So if you want to schedule your showing for one of these premium lots with amazing unobstructed views, you can do that right now before they fill up. NatchezRVResort.com, NatchezRVResort.com. Okay, it is Thursday after all, and there's a lot going on in Florida, along the Gulf of America. Let's check in with my sister in our segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Miranda, you don't look frozen solid.
No.
You're fine. It's just,
I'm fine.
I always love watching the warm states panic when it's like, I don't know, what is it, 40 degrees?
Well, in Miami, it's 50s and 40s, but up north, it dropped well below freezing enough to actually drop snow from the sky.
Yeah, the pictures are cool. And I mean, it is. I love seeing a picture of palm trees like kind of frozen. It's funny. It's interesting.
Yeah.
But you sent me this thing where it was like it's literally this alert: stay off the roads. icy road conditions expected. Because, I mean, to be fair, if you have always lived in a place no snow, driving on ice is not a good idea.
No, it's true. And honestly, these southern states just are not equipped. Not only are the people not equipped, but the government, local governments aren't equipped to deal with snow removal and icy road situations. So it is safer for them to just be like, please don't drive because you guys don't know what you're doing and we can't help you. So they're just asking people to like, wait till the snow completely melts, because when you have temperatures that are jumping below and above freezing, you're going to get ice. It's science.
Yeah.
So some of the roads are pretty dangerous. And I did see there was, not in Florida, but there was some accidents involved in this whole situation. So,
well, I mean, you and I are very good at driving in snow, blizzard conditions. There were very few circumstances in the winter where we would not drive or wouldn't be expected to go to school because we grew up in a place that was always snowy. But when I got here, I also overestimated my ability because here we have hills and in Minnesota we didn't. And so, you know, I'd be like, oh, I can get up Queen Anne Hill in my car just fine. Like, no, sure can't. So, yeah. I also got to ask you about the Gulf of America, which, of course, borders Florida. And Ron DeSantis wasted no time. I think it was like the day after the change. Was it an emergency order he had put out on something where he listed it as the Gulf of America?
Yeah. So he had put out an emergency order. First, he referred to a low pressure system moving through the Gulf of America. Yeah. That was his first opportunity to use this blizzard snowstorm coming through Florida to refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America. And then also moving forward into other weather related announcements, they will be calling it the Gulf of America down here.
I'm very curious because, like, up here on the news, you know, we don't have reason to mention the Gulf of Mexico very often. So I'm very curious. You have to keep us updated on how quickly the news there adopts that language when they refer to in weather reports and stuff. Are they saying Gulf of Mexico still? Or are they saying Gulf of America? So I want to see how quickly the lingo changes.
Yeah, for sure. And I also kind of think about it in a real estate mentality. I think a lot of people who live on the Gulf side use that kind of like je ne sais quoi of it being the Gulf of Mexico to rent out vacation rentals and stuff. Oh. I don't know how many people are going to want to come from America to the Gulf of America on vacation.
That's a good, it does give it this exotic feel, if you will.
Does. So it'll be interesting to see who latches onto it, who pushes against it. We'll see what happens this year.
So obviously pardons this week for 1,500 or so J6ers. In fact, we have a J6er who got a pardon coming up on our Sunday show, Sundays with Subscribers, who's going to tell his story, John Cameron. I know a lot of the J6ers who got pardons were from Florida. So a lot of them are celebrating. I see this online, you know, oh, thank God. Not one in Florida who was immediately arrested for other crimes.
Yeah, not even one day after he was pardoned, he got rearrested for pre-existing charges of possessing a gun while he's a felon, because he also has three prior felony convictions. So I think he's a good example of the reason this shouldn't have been a blanket pardon. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people in there that, yes, they do not deserve to be, you know, locked up and charged with certain things, but I think there was a lot of people that just have a kind of a criminal mentality and they just took advantage of a situation. So I do think that they should have maybe went through this a little bit more case to case, because then you get people like this that probably shouldn't have been just let go.
Yeah, because that would have been kind of another crime on top of a long, you know, criminal track record as it is, rap sheet. And so it's like, oh, now he just gets kind of a freebie. So I agree with you. It's like, you got to look at these things. I mean, for a lot of them, I agree with the pardon. For some of them, as I hear individual stories, I'm like, not so much. Maybe a commutation, but let's keep it on his rap sheet so people know down the road the extent of his criminal conduct. So, all right, Miranda, stay warm. Thank you so much.
I will. Have a good weekend.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Yeah, sorry. Excuse me while I don't feel bad for Floridians that they have to deal with cold weather for like a few days. No sympathy here. All right, so Donald Trump, a lot of his executive orders had to do with sort of trying to jumpstart the economy. He directed all of his agencies to do what they can to try to ease inflation. One of the things, though, is, you know, I see this like these disingenuous people on the internet being like, oh, did you get what you want, Mega? The cost of eggs is still real high. And it's like, okay, not going to be fixed. The cost of eggs is really high. I will say it's like $10 a dozen, which is insane. We should do a segment next week on why eggs have gone through the roof, because there are some reasons that you can be attributed to that. But I think there's this overarching question of how long will it take, or how quickly can the Trump administration try to undo some of the economic damage that was done by the Biden administration? We asked our friend Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital. I was just doing an interview with someone where they were talking about the hope that interest rates would come down. Like, how long before interest rates come down under Trump? Is it realistic to expect that that's going to be something that could happen quickly?
Well, yes and no. So, the way it stands today, like, people need to realize under the current setup, Trump does not have the authority to fire Jay Powell. And as long as the laws exist the way they are, the Fed has full authority over interest rate policy. Mm-hmm. So that's really not up to Trump. How soon will interest rates come down? I don't know. Look, here's the tough part about it. And this is the thing that I wish that they would do a better job, especially now that he's electing. I think they need to do a much better job messaging this. The quickest way to bring down inflation is to pull back on the money supply. Okay, that's it. It's one of the easiest ways. So, like, if we look back, for instance, to the Great Depression, right, we know that it was the opposite of inflation. It was deflation, right? Well, you go back and look post, like, 1932, and from 1929 to 1932, the money supply had shrunk by 30%. Okay, so we know how to bring down inflation. The question is can you bring it down without bringing the economy down at the same time, right? And so with the messaging, I would be encouraging the administration to say is, hey, guys, this problem took 4 years to create. It's going to take a little while to fix. Here's what we got to do. We got to thread the needle. What we're trying to do is we're going to try to use DOGE and responsible spending cuts to bring the level, to bring the deficit down. They need to get the deficit debt back down more to at least the 5% range, away from 7. We're still spending just insane amounts of money. But what you got to do is you got to have some spending cuts, and those spending cuts in and of themselves will be a negative to GDP. They will be. Okay. So what you got to do is, in my opinion, you got to use the playbook that Milei has deployed so well in Argentina. And what you got to do is you got to use increases in productivity or increases in economic activity to help offset that spending cut, right? Easiest way to do that is cut regulations. So what I would say, if I were talking in a complete non-political setting and was just being really honest about what I thought, I think if you did here's the other tough thing. We're also not going to get a result on inflation as quick as Argentina did. And the reason why is because Argentina was in a really bad place, right? Mm-hmm. They had to their backs were against the wall. Ours aren't. So he was able to use that as political impetus to get the legislators in this country to go along with much more what we'd consider draconian or, you know, intent, you know, extraordinary cuts and extraordinary regulation, changes, right? Or pulling back on regulations in general. So, but I would just be prepping people. This is probably going to take, you know, for us, it's probably going to take at least 4 to 6 years, probably, to get back to what we'd consider a normal level of inflation, which would probably be about 2.5, maybe 3%.
Wow. So that's not what people want to hear.
No, but what, and this is why I want him to get out ahead of it, though, because, you know, talk about a perfect political line. Hey, guys, this is a mess that took 4 years to make. It's going to take a couple years to fix.
Yeah. Zach and his team are talking about 2025, the economic outlook and all of that. They're going to have another one of their Know Your Risk Live webinars. If you're concerned about your retirement, et cetera, your investments, next Thursday, I think it's at 3 or 3:30 p.m., but you can sign up right now for free. KnowYourRiskRadio.com. KnowYourRiskRadio.com. They'll go over 2025, give a preview, talk about the new administration, how it could impact your retirement portfolio, and then do a full reveal of how Bulwark is always looking for opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, give your retirement as much upside as possible. So you can sign up now, knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com. All right, let's fit a couple questions in. I do have to be out relatively on time today. I'm already a little bit over. Baron of Gray Matter with a $5 super chat. We're living behind a socialist iron curtain. USA will be enjoying our new administration benefits. We will suffer here in Washington. Brandy is radio free Washington. What does that mean? I don't know what that means. Radio Free Washington.
I'm not really sure.
I'm not either. That's okay. I read it anyway. Tabitha Payton. I'm 100.
At the beginning, you talked about working for them and not having to worry about everybody else. Maybe it had something to do with that.
Okay. Gotcha.
I don't know.
Tabitha Payton. I'm 100% with you. They can butt out and let us raise our own kids. Yeah. You'd think that that wouldn't be controversial. Apparently it is. All right. Woody with a $2 super chat. Maybe we don't want the education you're pushing. Exactly. You shouldn't, because kids are failing. So, I mean, any parent that says, yeah, I'll take that, there's a problem there. Krista, this woman is the exact reason that parents need to be informed of what's happening in these schools. Yeah, I can see why she'd want to keep secrets from parents. Adorable deplorable. No state wants to hear from their citizens less than Washington State. And who can blame them? The voters of this state are remarkably consistent in voting them in over and over and over again. Yep. Let's see. Time to move to Olympia, Brandy. You just walk out the door and then boom, a new show title hits you right in the face. Yeah. Richard Dixon, the future of Washington looks bleak. I don't want to believe that.
I do believe that this is something, I mean, we're not everybody's going to cover these things.
No.
And you've got to tell your friends that they're, what they're doing by presenting these bills, that these cutesy little names and, we're just trying to help.
Yeah,
clarify things and make things
so
better.
Nice of you.
So make sure you tell your friends, because this is crazy.
All the tricks they're pulling. Rick Johnson, how many kids are in these categories that they feel are infringed and marginalized? Are we talking about 3%? This is insane. Once again, I would be surprised if it's even 3%. Mm-hmm. I mean, in some school districts for sure that are more like ideologically driven. I mean, Olympia, I bet it's double digits.
Because they're confusing children.
Right, because they're intentionally confusing children. But for those people who are supportive of this agenda, you know, I have a new anthem for them. So if you're supportive of the indoctrination of kids, I have your song of the summer that you'll just be able to blast and it'll get stuck right in your head. Let's talk about it in our closing sanity check. All right, this catchy tune titled BIPOC comes to us from a singer named Molly Gawler. Let's listen to her tune entitled BIPOC.
Black and indigenous people of color.
Turn it up a little bit, Nicole.
Black and indigenous people of color. Ooh. Lesbian, gay, bi, transgender, and queer. Lesbian, gay, bi, transgender, and queer. Asian American Pacific Islander. Asian American Pacific Islander. Latino, Hispanic, Romani, and Creole.
Woo!
Latino, Hispanic, Romani, and Creole. We all have a place in this world.
Woo! That was nice.
We all have a place.
Bring it home, girl.
In this world.
Yeah, I like the chest drum beat. Hey, you know, great voice. Here's the thing. I agree 100%. We all have a place in this world, in the country that we're a legal citizen of, and in a job that we're actually qualified for. That has been your sanity check for today. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Again, we've got a great episode of Sundays with Subscribers this week. So a good time to become a subscriber if you've not already. It's just $5 a month. John Cameron, a J6er from Washington State who just got a pardon from Donald Trump, is going to talk to us about what happened on that day in 2021. And about what he's went through and some of the personal losses he has suffered in his life as a result. So I look forward to that conversation. We'll also have a new episode of Politics Unpacked tomorrow. We try to fit everything that happened of importance in the legislative session that week into a tiny 10-minute package. I don't give my opinion. I just zip it. Just give you the facts, what went down, and that's kind of it. Nicole, you look like you want to add something.
No, I'm good, I think.
Okay.
You covered it.
All right, cool.
We'll be back.
Okay, bye, buddies.
Then.
Ooh, save the owls. Ooh. Ooh. Ooh, ooh. I'm just a little owl with big eyes.
Just let me be.
Don't shoot me.